The following's intended solely for the use of those with a sense of adventure.
I'm shaking the dust of this town off my feet, and I'm going to see the world.
This is Travel with Hawkeye. Here's your host, Mark Hawkeye Lewis.
We are going all over the globe on this week's episode of Travel with Hawkeye, our skiing episode. I'm so excited about this. I'm a huge skier. I love to ski, and I like to combine the two loves of travel and ski. And so today, we're going, as I said, all over the globe. We're talking to a ski operator who takes people skiing in Japan, in South America, in India. We're talking to a ski resort that you could rent all by yourself. It's the only ski resort in America that you can rent and have it all to yourself or with just your friends. It's just outside of New York City. We'll talk to an operator there. It's a family-owned ski resort. We'll also talk to another ski resort operator who runs a very special, different kind of ski resort on a private ranch in Utah that is open to people who want to heli-ski or cat-ski. It's an incredible opportunity for those who want to do some backcountry skiing. And then also, we're going to give our review of Breckenridge Ski Resort. We got a chance to visit that just a couple of weeks ago, and we'll talk about that. We're going to start this morning with a gentleman who just wrote an article recently for the New York Times. Gabriel Lee joins us. And of all the places to review, he decided to review skiing in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. And I guess the first question I got to ask you here, Gabriel, today is, how did you decide to go skiing in Georgia?
I was actually talking about it with my brother-in-law. We live in Sweden, and there's a Georgian restaurant in Stockholm that he had been to, and he was talking about Georgian food. And then I sort of was thinking about, you know, interesting places that we might go this winter to try and ski. And he snowboards, I ski. And because we were talking about Georgian food, then I said, oh, yeah, I think I've heard they have, you know, some nice mountains there. So then we started looking into it, and, you know, the more I looked into it, the more interesting it seemed.
And tell everybody. But first of all, the mountain range, I've seen it spelled out before, but I've never really heard it properly pronounced. So how would you pronounce the mountain range that it's in?
Oh, the Caucasus.
Caucasus. Okay, the Caucasus. Yeah. And yeah. So you decided to go to Georgia. And what did you have to do to get ready to go to Georgia? I mean, did you just buy a ticket and like, or did you make some pre-plans, or did you have to get some visa? I mean, how difficult was it to go skiing in Georgia?
It's pretty easy, actually. And I mean, at least if you're coming from somewhere in Europe, flights are reasonable. You know, it wasn't expensive at all. I think we spent something like $200 round trip.
Wow.
Yeah. The only thing about the flights are that they have terrible times. Like, it's one of these places where you end up having to arrive at 4 a.m. and leave around a similar time. So getting in and leaving is really tough. You know, it's one of these places that has a really big exotic payoff for how, you know, you don't actually have to travel that far to be in this really different place. You know, so we flew via Riga on Air Baltic, and it's, you know, not even a 3-hour flight from Riga to Tbilisi, you feel really far away. But that means you do a kind of, you know, 2.5-hour, 3-hour red eye and ending up in Tbilisi at 4 or 5 in the morning. And then, you know, we decided to head out and drive to the first place straight away. So it was kind of an intense travel day. But, you know, no visas required. It's really easy. They're really kind of open to people coming. They want you there. So it didn't take much, actually.
And what was the skiing like when you got there?
We started off, I think it's mentioned in the article, but we started off in this place called Bakuryani, which is not in the Caucasus. It's sort of in the kind of less impressive mountains, which are to the south, kind of west, southwest of Tbilisi. And that's kind of like a more of a family holiday resort mountain town. Like, a lot of people from Tbilisi like to go there for the weekends. It's this funny little town, and the skiing is good, but it's not as incredible. But, you know, it's got good snow, and it's got a kind of – it's unusual. It's an interesting place to visit. Whereas, you know, the second place we went, which was up in the North Caucasus, which is where the real high mountains and the biggest ski resort in Georgia is, this place called Gudauri, that has, you know – kind of much more impressive mountains. It's higher, it's above the tree line, there was a lot of snow. So it was, you know, kind of more impressive looking, and a lot more in terms of, you know, vertical drop and range of things that you could do, and much more in terms of like backcountry skiing. But the place, the actual town there, is not as interesting. So it's kind of a trade-off.
Yeah, what was the accommodations when you went there?
Well, in Bakuryani, we ended up actually getting an Airbnb, which is, they have a bunch of, you know, kind of recently built, not so memorable, not so special, but fine, like comfortable enough kind of chalets, you know, kind of, modern, not that great,
yeah.
but it's okay, you know, and they have some hotels there too, but in the end we decided that a place like this with three bedrooms, it was a better choice, more economical and kind of, you know, easy. And then when we were in Gudauri, we stayed actually just north of there, closer to the Russian border at a really impressive place. That place is called the Rooms Hotel, and it's they've got a couple of them in Georgia. They're building more, and it's really like the best sort of group of hotels you could stay in when you're there. They have one in Tbilisi. They're working on one in Bakuriani, actually, and they're just, yeah, that place is amazing. It's really impressive. It's like surrounded by really big peaks. And, you know, being so close to Russia, it's an interesting feeling.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm always interested in former Soviet republics. What is it like there now politically and economically?
I think it's still, it's kind of complicated. You know, there's a kind of general feeling that, you know, the Georgians I spoke to anyway, you know, I can't really speak for all of them because the people that are living in the little mountain towns, they tend to be poor. They tend to not speak English. They speak Russian, if anything. I don't speak any Russian. So I don't really have I didn't really get the thoughts of those people. But the people that I did speak to who speak English, they tend to be very, you know, proud of their country and sort of, you know, eager to maintain that independence and show the world that they're not, you know, they're not a Soviet place. They're something different.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot of tensions with Russia because Russia is, you know, they would say occupying parts of their country. And they like to, you know, apparently they like to move the border a little bit at a time, you know, and just sort of see what they can get away with. And obviously they have a much more powerful military than Georgia does. So it's, you know, it's a tricky one. It's something they struggle with, I guess.
Yeah, it's kind of the great untold story because a lot of people are focused on the Ukraine, but the same thing's kind of happening in Georgia.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they had that kind of, I don't remember how many years back it was, they had an actual conflict that happened in the north there. You know, not far from where this area that we're talking about. Otherwise, it's very a low boil thing. It's just, you know, like I said, little, you know, moving the border a foot forward, you know, a week, that kind of thing, and seeing, you know, kind of saying like, what are you going to do about it? So, you know, there's not, you know, active warfare going on, but it is kind of tense. That being said, it doesn't feel like a place that's about to boil over and get crazy.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, you're aware that, you know, for the Georgians, this is a source of, you know, a source of tension and something they would like to, they wish wasn't a factor, I guess.
Yeah. The second resort you went to also got a little internet fame not too long ago. That's the resort that had the malfunctioning lift, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, this crazy video came out just a few weeks after we were there, actually.
Yeah, the lift just went backwards at pretty high speed, and people had to jump off the lift, and all the seats ended up getting kind of squashed together, smashed together, kind of at the beginning and the entry point there. It was, I remember that went viral. And then when I read your story, you know, you mentioned that, like, that's where that video was from. It was very interesting. I guess they got that problem fixed.
I guess so, yeah. And I, you know, I still don't know what exactly went wrong there. I couldn't find any information about what happened. I've never seen anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that it was moving backwards and so fast and that they had no way to stop it, and it's just crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to post it on our blog, so if people don't know what we're talking about, can check out the video there. Okay, I got to ask you two quick questions here. First of all, you mentioned this at the beginning, Georgian food. That's, you were at a Georgian food restaurant. What is Georgian food like?
Well, I mean, you know, Georgia is at the sort of middle of this kind of incredible crossroads of cultures and cuisines, and you can kind of sense that in the food. It's also really, you know, it's a mountain country, and you feel that in the food too. It's food that's kind of like comfort food, I guess, but it's got this really exotic range of flavors, you know. So it's meats and potatoes and breads. You know, they're really into their bread that are the bread they call khachapuri, and you have different varieties, all sorts of varieties of the khachapuri, which, you know, the best one, my favorite, is one that they sort of melt a bunch of cheese and butter and put an egg in the middle. And you just kind of, you know, this is something you buy from like street side stalls, you know, a lot of meat stews, a lot of, you know, kind of interesting herbs and spices and things you haven't kind of quite tasted before. If you haven't been in the region much, you know, you feel the Middle Eastern influence, you feel the kind of, you know, something interesting to know about Georgian food is that, you know, apparently I'm told in the days of the Soviet Union, if you wanted to get good food in a place like Moscow or a Soviet city, you would go to the Georgian restaurant. That was known to be, you know,
oh, interesting.
If you wanted decent food. And it kind of still has that has that kind of distinction, I think.
Very cool. Well, the thing that I got from your article too is it's really inexpensive to ski there. Is it worth the trip? Maybe not going from the U.S. all the way to Georgia, but if you're in Europe, is it worth the trip?
I think so. I mean, if you're interested in that part of the world, you know, I think you have to have a little bit of an appetite for adventure. You know, it's sometimes not so easy to travel there. I mean, you can move around, and you know, it's not dangerous. It's safe, but the you know, talking to people and figuring out the place and what to do and where to go can be a little tricky. But if you're into a bit of adventure, I think it's a really great return on your investment in terms of adventure for, like, you know, what it takes, the fact that it's actually relatively pretty close. But you get this kind of really, really special place, really exotic kind of feeling. And it's unlike any other place in a way, because it's sort of had all these different influences. And, you know, of course, then there's the relatively affordable skiing. I mean, and Tbilisi is a really cool city too. So if you went, you could stay there a few days, and, you know, there you can get a great old apartment on Airbnb for $10 a night or whatever. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's really, and there's increasingly cool stuff to do. You know, the young people in Tbilisi who speak good English, they're like really happy to meet you. You know, you end up in a lot of fun situations, and you know, I think if you're into a little bit of adventure, I would definitely recommend it.
Well, cool. Very cool. Okay. The final question here is, how many people have you told that you went skiing in Georgia and they thought you went skiing in the United States?
Well, I head them off at the pass because I know that that's a problem. So I always say Republic of Georgia.
Yeah. Well, Gabriel, thanks for sharing your adventure with us. Really appreciate it.
Of course, no problem.
A quick reminder, don't forget to go to our website, travelwithhawkeye.net. Click on our blog. We'll have links to all the places we talked about on our skiing episode of this week's podcast, and also links to the articles that we talked about, like Daniel's article about him skiing in Georgia. You can check it out there. And I'm also going to put the video up there, too, of the ski lift that went backwards at incredible speeds. You got to check out this video. It's at travelwithhawkeye.net, and click on the blog. All right, let me ask you a question. Have you ever wanted to have a ski resort all to yourself? I mean, as soon as you get on the lift, there's nobody on the lift. You get off the lift, there's nobody in front of you. Maybe it's just you and your friends. Well, there actually is a ski resort just north of New York City called Platte Hill Mountain. It's a family-owned resort, and they actually rent it out to folks during the week where you could have it all to yourself or to your friends or to your office group or your clients, whatever you desire. And Daniel Vitte, one of the owners of this family-owned resort, joins us here today on the Travel with Hawkeye podcast. Before I ask about this special deal that you guys do and all about the resort, I got to ask you, first of all, this, I did a little research on you and your husband. Is it true that you and your husband met before you were married, working at Platte Hill Mountain, before you guys owned the resort?
That's correct. Yep. We met here very many, many years ago here on the mountain. I was a ski instructor. My husband was ski school director at the time, so I worked for him. And, we worked several years together here on the mountain. That's how we met and got to know each other, and here we are.
And then at one point, you guys decided to buy the entire resort, correct?
Yes, in 1993, my husband purchased Platte Hill. Got a Small Business Administration loan, and Dollar in a Dream decided that he wanted to make a go of trying to make the ski resort work.
You know what? I'm going to be honest. It's kind of always been my dream to have my own ski resort, a family-owned ski resort. Is the dream as exciting, or is it just like, oh my gosh, today I got to unplug the toilet down in the men's bathroom? It's not as glamorous as it sounds.
There's all that, especially with a small family mountain. I mean, we definitely wear all hats. So, I mean, as maybe glorious as it might sound to run a ski resort, in all reality, you know, it's all hands on deck. Certain days are crazy busy, other days not so much. Of course, being that we're a ski resort, we're so weather dependent, not only as far as conditions, but also, you know, getting customers motivated to come out and ski. You know, who knows what the weather has been in their backyard. So that can have such a huge effect on, you know, what type of skiers come out on a given weekend. So, you know, if the stars all align and the snow is great and we've had great snow and there's snow in people's backyards and everybody's thinking skiing, you know, it can be a really busy day. And like I said, it's all hands on deck. We do whatever we have to do to get it, you know, to get it done. It sounds glorious. It certainly has its great, great days, you know, and very gratifying to see, you know, people. I mean, this is people's fun time. This is
yes.
their recreation time. This is
yes.
what they love to do. They're at your business because you provided something that they love. So it's very rewarding to be able to offer that product and have people here and just having a like, you know, an amazing time. And this is what they've chosen to spend their free time. So it's been, you know, that can be obviously probably the most rewarding.
Well, one of the things you do, because there's, you know, a lot of difficulty, especially when you're going up against larger resorts, to fill, you know, to get crowds in, especially on weekdays. So you guys decided to do something, according to this article in New York Times, is you could actually rent out the entire resort. Now, how long ago did you guys come up with that idea?
That dates back now. I'm going to say we've been renting them out and out for, oh boy, maybe 10 years now. Started out really small. Started out with just a, you know, originally originated when some skiers just kind of came here after we'd have like a snowfall. Skiers would come here and they'd just want to hike the mountain. They weren't expecting any lifts, of course, because we were closed Monday through Thursday. We're typically closed. So they would come on a Wednesday, let's say, after a snow dump. And they'd just say, would it be okay if we hiked the mountain? So we said, you know, sure, of course. So they would go up, they'd hike the mountain and ski some amazing snow. And then these customers kind of circled back around to us and would say, how much, like, what would it take for you guys to turn the lifts on for us? You know, and it was like, no, we can't do that. You know, there's not enough. And, you know, they would say, no, seriously, like, how, we would be willing to pay you to open the mountain for us. Like, so then that whole kind of concept sort of started. And then what kind of it turned into first off was Powder Days, which we actually labeled an actual day here at the mountain called Powder Days. And anytime it would snow a foot or more, we would open up. So Monday through Thursday, if we weren't open, it wasn't an operating day, we'd turn on the lifts and the skiers would come. We'd promote it as a powder day. We would do no grooming. Again, a foot or more of snow, people would come out and we'd spin the lifts. And that really grew as far as, you know, people catching on and coming out for powder days. The problem was the powder days were, you know, few and far between.
Yes, yeah.
So then what kind of happened next was people would say, well, I don't need it to open just for like a powder day per se. How would I get a how could I rent this just so like I could come up and just have a day on the mountain, not necessarily a powder day? So then we said, oh, now we're on to something else. So we thought, well, why not? And we had a couple of groups approach us. It started out kind of more corporate groups. That it became like we had some religious groups come. Then we had people who were kind of liking the idea as a potential fundraiser. So all these different opportunities sort of came about. And then we decided that we were going to start to offer private mountain rentals available Monday through Thursday to the public. And then it's really caught on since then. I mean, this year we have probably only a couple of dates actually still available for rent.
Wow. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And now the article in the New York Times about it, that's probably just exploded.
That's true. That is true. And you're getting all sorts of, you know, ideas, you know, people wanting to rent it for the gamut of ideas, you know, a sweet 16 party, a bachelor party, a production company that wants to come up and do a filming of a commercial. You know, it's just so many different ideas you can think of when you offer up that opportunity to have a whole mountain.
Yeah.
Yourself.
I wonder if other people are going to take your business model. Since you said you only have a few days left this year that have not been rented out during the weekday.
Well, you know, there's very few mountains like us that actually operate with this type of a schedule. You know, Monday, to be closed Monday through Thursday and only operate 3 days a week is some of these larger ski resorts. You know, it's very hard to, you know, staff them up, the staffing that they need on the days when they, you know, that they would be open, that they need to have full-time staff, you know what I mean? That's
yes.
on their staffing. So for a smaller mountain like us, we have that flexibility to, you know, call in staff, you know, if we have a mountain rented. So I think it's just a little, would be way more of a challenge for a larger mountain to do that. And I think too, I mean, a larger mountains too, people are, you know, expect the larger mountains to be open 7 days a week. So it would be a hard concept to now close and only do it privately. So yeah. I think that there'd only be, you know, it's a certain type of a mountain, like a smaller mountain like ourselves, that are really kind of able to offer this sort of like niche opportunity.
Well, how far are you from New York City? How far a drive is it from the city?
We're just about 3 hours from Manhattan.
Okay. All right.
Probably just a little under.
Well, I'm looking at your trail map now as we talk, and it looks like such a fun place to ski. You have like you have some great expert terrain, and it just looks like a fun mountain. And it's, you know, it's not that big. There's really only two main lifts and some smaller lifts. But you know what? I always say, You can only really ski one run at a time. So how big of a resort do you need? I love the little family-owned place, and I'm going to salute you guys for sticking in there and doing great. And the one question I have to ask is I said it's always been kind of a fantasy to have my own ski resort. How often does Danielle get to ski?
certainly not as much as I used to, but I will say that my husband does get out there quite a bit. I mean, it is important for us to know the product that we're offering our guests. It's important to make sure that everything is functioning properly on the outside. So, you know, it's important that we do get out there on the slopes and experience it firsthand. So he does get a chance to get out there quite a bit. I like to go out there more, you know, once things have kind of calmed down on the end of a weekend by Sunday afternoon. So I get out there sometimes myself, too.
Well, Danielle, continued success with Plattekill, and great idea, and thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you so much for calling us.
A reminder once again, don't forget to go to our website, travelwithhawkeye.net, click on the blog, and we'll have a link to Plattekill Mountain. And you know what? I'll have a link also to that article in the New York Times. It's a pretty challenging mountain. That's what they say is if you're an advanced skier, it's got some entry into the backcountry. It's got a lot of black runs, and it's a pretty interesting mountain. So I would love to go up there someday, and I have not done a lot of skiing on the East Coast. I've actually only been to Killington on the East Coast, so that is definitely on my radar. I have done a lot of skiing on the West Coast, and I have skied every major resort in Colorado, in New Mexico, and Utah, at Lake Tahoe. I've skied in Oregon and Washington and Wyoming. And I like to, you know, people always ask me, hey, you know, what's a good resort for me and my family? We're going skiing for the first time, or have you been to this resort? And so I always like to kind of give my reviews. And I have a bit of a review on our blog at travelwithhawkeye.net about Breckenridge, which I went to a couple of weeks ago. And so these are just some random musings about Breckenridge. First of all, I've been going to Breckenridge for probably over 20 years now, and it's almost doubled in size since I started going there. And it's really almost like two different mountains. There's Peak 6, 7, and 8, which if you look on the map are on the right side of the map, and there's Peaks 9 and 10, which are on the left side of the map. And they're kind of separated by a valley, so the skiing between those two peaks, there's only a couple trails and there's some lifts go, but it really separates the resort into two different mountain or two different sides of the map. And what I really like about Breckenridge is I'm always taking people who have never skied before, and I think Breckenridge is one of the most perfect places to teach someone to ski. Now, I will say, though, it is expensive. I think a lift ticket's well over $150 now. I have the Epic Pass this year, so I'm not sure what it actually was since I've already paid for the Epic Pass, but it is expensive. But if you've gone skiing just a couple of times, you're learning to ski, I think it's one of the best places. One of the reasons is on Peak 9, there are so many wide green runs, and they have probably the best variety of green runs that I've ever seen. And then the blue runs, if you're ready to move up to a blue run, they're pretty easy also on Peak 9. And there's challenging blue runs, and there's black runs, and there's some incredible double blacks. I mean, they have everything at Breckenridge. There's really something for everything. But if you're learning to ski, or it's only your second or third time, I think it's one of the best places to go. I took my family there on their second time to ski, and they got so much better so quickly because they were on blue runs on their second time out there. And it's so accommodating, and the crowds really, the way it's kind of set up now with the gondola, they really stay on the right side of the map on Peak 6, 7, and 8 for the most part. And every time I've been there, Peak 9 and 10, a lot less crowded. So there's that. I think it's a great place to learn, though I will say the lift tickets, it's part of the Vail Corporation, kind of expensive, and you have to put that into the equation. I really do like that. Also, the town of Breckenridge, I think, is one of the best ski towns out there. It's not a real town like Aspen is, I'm sure there's some people who live in Breckenridge. It's really a super tourist town, but it's such a great super tourist town because there's a main street that's got a lot of restaurants and bars and places to hang out, pre-ski places, and I think it's just one of the best towns out there for skiing. So I highly recommend also Breckenridge. The altitude is very high, though. That town of Breckenridge, I think, is at 8,000 feet for the town, which is one of the highest towns out there. A couple other things, too, that I noticed or that I did that I like to pass along. I was able to do this last minute. I actually did not get a hotel till like just a couple days before because I went on a weekend that I knew was going to be kind of a dead weekend. And I used an app called Hotel Tonight. Highly recommend that app. It's anywhere you go, not just skiing, but if you're going somewhere and you know it's not going to be a busy weekend, you can roll the dice a little bit. Hotel tonight. I got probably the best place I've ever stayed at a ski resort. It was right off a 4 o'clock run, so I could ski right to my condo. It had a fireplace. It was a beautiful condo, and I got it for about one-third the normal price because it was obviously inventory at this hotel, at this condo, that wasn't going to be used. So they used that app, Hotel Tonight, and offered a discount price. Now, if I had gone like on Martin Luther King Day weekend, or I'm sure that condo would not have been available. But like I said, it was a weekend, or even if you're going on a weekday, I bet you could find it too. So something else, man, a couple of things about going from the airport in Denver to ski country to Summit County. First of all, I signed up for TSA PreCheck. I didn't get it in time for this trip, but I cannot wait to use it because the last two times I've been to the airport, that TSA PreCheck line is so short. Highly recommend TSA PreCheck. I'm tired of taking off my shoes and my jacket and my laptop and my ditty bag, as my dad would call it, out of my suitcase on my carry-on luggage. So I've signed up for TSA PreCheck. It's $85 if you can afford it. I highly recommend that. The line is always shorter and you get right through. Here's something else about the Denver airport. They offered free ice skating this year during the holiday season. I went there, it was the last day. World's smallest ice rink, I will give them that. But they offered not only ice skating, but free skate rental. And I thought that was a pretty cool thing. Here's one more thing about also on the drive from the Denver airport out to Summit County if you're going out there. Man, that I-70, if you live in Denver and you ski a lot, that I-70 is a tough situation. It's the main road that goes from Denver through the mountains, through the Eisenhower Tunnel, and all the major ski resorts are on it. Vail, Beaver Creek, Breckenridge, Keystone, Copper Mountain, they're all right there. If you go to some of the smaller ones, you got to go also that direction. If you're going to Winter Park or if you're going to Loveland, you got to take I-70 also before you get to the tunnel. There's a turnoff. So there's a lot of people who are skiing every weekend. And when you come back on Sunday, it is just packed. That is tough. And you really got to make accommodations for that if you're headed out to the airport on a Sunday night. A 3 hour drive took like 5 hours because of traffic. So that's a tough situation. The other thing too, I noticed, Colorado has legalized marijuana, and I'm not one who partakes in marijuana. I don't really have a problem with other people. There was a guy. It was funny. When I was taking the gondola up in Breckenridge. A guy asked if he could light a joint up in the gondola, and I asked him not to because I didn't want to smell like pot all day, and the gondola, the windows were closed, and he was cool about it. You know, I said, yeah, I don't really have a problem with that, but I kind of wish you wouldn't do it in the gondola. And he was like, oh, cool, no problem. He goes, but you know what? He goes, I like to go up in the, as I call it, the gondola, which I thought was pretty funny. Here's the thing, though. I swear to God, I saw an outlet store for a marijuana dispensary. Now, they have a lot of these dispensaries now. They usually have a green cross. There was like a dispensary outlet store. What do they sell there? Like broken bongs or like Justin Bieber bongs that didn't sell, or just like a really bad mix of like stems and seeds that don't? I mean, an outlet store for a dispensary? Well, I guess they got everything now. Anyway, Breckenridge, if you're looking for a place to go, you'll probably have a good time in Breckenridge. It's a great ski resort, a little expensive, especially the lift tickets every day, unless you have the Epic Pass. The town is great. It's a great place to take a family, except for, of course, the expense of the lift tickets. But one of my favorite places to go. I think I've been there 5 or 6 times. I've lost track, but it's definitely definitely great. Find out more about Breckenridge on our website, travelwithhawkeye.net. Click on our blog for this episode, and we'll tell you more and give you some links and so forth. Now, if skiing a big-time resort like Breckenridge or Copper Mountain or Vail isn't enough for you, you're looking for something a bit more exciting, maybe you need to go to the website, theadventureproject.net. We'll have a link to this website on our blog. Matt Appleford joins us from The Adventure Project. And first of all, tell people what this is that you do.
An adventure ski and snowboard travel company based in Denver, but we travel all over the world. And the idea is to try and take people on adventures. We like to take people off the beaten path to exotic locations where you can have good snow and explore exciting and interesting foreign cultures.
There seems to be three places that you're focused on your website, theadventureproject.net. And I'm gonna save the most exotic one for last, okay? Because that is the one that's like blew my mind because I didn't even know they had skiing there. But one is Chile. And where do you guys go in Chile?
Yeah, so we head down to a ski area called Nevada State Chillán. It's about 500 kilometers south of Santiago, a little bit more off the beaten path, and relatively few Westerners going down there. And yeah, just an amazing ski area, good snow record, and very friendly locals, and very good food. So we've just added in for this summer an additional add-on for people that want to head down to the ocean. There's an eco resort that we've discovered, and you can go down there. They're right on the beach. You can go surfing. They have amazingly fresh seafood. So to be able to ski on a volcano one day and then the next day hang out on the beach and do some surfing is pretty special. Not too many places where you can do that.
No, you know what? I call that the ultimate double play, where you can ski one day and then swim in the ocean the next day. I've gotten to do that once ever in my life when I got to go to I skied in Hawaii off Mauna Kea.
Oh, nice.
So I got to do that one time. It's very rare. There's not very many places in the world you can do that. That's pretty cool. All right. So that's one of the exotic places that you go. The other is Japan, and that's on my bucket list. I've always wanted to ski in Japan. Where do you go in Japan?
We're currently focused on Hokkaido, which is the North Island. We do a 12-day trip, and every group has their own guide plus a van. And then we basically drive around a lot and go and experience lots of different resorts. And the resorts that we're focused on are more of the under-the-radar places where, I mean, everywhere on that island has a pretty good track record for snow. But we try and find the places, again, where there are fewer Westerners going. So to increase the chances of getting untouched powder, you need to go to the places where there's few Westerners. So I think we have a pretty good list of places that we go to. And then also this winter, we're starting up a whole brand new trip, slightly different area, just across the ocean on the far northern tip of the mainland of Honshu. We're heading to an area called Tohoku with a couple of groups of return clients, and we're going to explore a whole new area.
Well, let me ask you this. I understand the appeal to going to Chile because you get to ski in the summer, but obviously there's a certain cost to skiing in Japan. Kind of give me the elevator pitch on why you would want to go to Japan. I know I want to go, but for people listening, like, why would they want that extra expense? What is it, the cultural experience? Is it the great snow?
Both of those, definitely. I think Japan is becoming more and more on people's radars here in the U.S. And I think the main reason you go to Japan is the quality of the snow, not only the amount that they get, but also the dry powder as well, with very low moisture content. A lot of the resorts, if you find the right ones, can be very uncrowded. So it's not that hard to get really good quality, untouched, deep snow. And then also there's the cultural components. I mean, I would never recommend that people come on any of our trips for just solely the skiing alone. So never come on our trips just for the skiing alone. You know, come to experience the local cultures that we're going to expose you to as well. And in Japan, definitely a lot of amazing culture there. The Japanese people, extremely friendly. Their way of life is very interesting. And the food as well is really, really good. So it's a very diverse trip. But if you want some of the best snow, some of the best culture, then Japan should definitely be on any adventurous skier and snowboarder's bucket list.
And definitely it's on mine. But okay, here's the third place that you go to. And I didn't even know they had skiing there until I talked to you. You also take people to the nation of India.
Yes. So this has been our longest running trip. This will actually be my 10th winter heading out to India this upcoming season. And, yeah, there's a ski area in the northern part of India in the state of Kashmir called Gulmarg. Not too many people know about Gulmarg, but it is known for having one of the world's highest gondolas in the world. They get a lot of snow, and there's hardly anyone there. So the way that we kind of sell the place is if you ever wanted to go heli skiing but didn't quite have the money, then Gulmarg can give you a similar level of experience where you have a massive mountain. They get a ton of snow, and there's hardly anyone there. It's very affordable. If you wanted to buy a lift ticket, you can buy per run, and that would cost you about $5. A weekly ski pass to Gulmarg is about $140.
Oh, my gosh. For a week.
You can get 4,000 vertical feet untouched powder runs. I even have a 7.5 mile off-piste run, one of the longest runs in the world that will take you most of the day to ski it. And again, they also have amazing culture as well. The people there are very friendly, lots of good food. It's a very rewarding trip. And some people say that there's your life before Kashmir, and then there's your life after Kashmir. And just to ski in the Himalayas alone is pretty unique in itself. So it's been our longest running trip. And definitely one that not many people know about, but one that you should, because it is an unbelievable place.
Well, you said not a lot of people ski there in the Himalayas. When you go there, are the people from India? Are the people from all over the world? Where are the other skiers from?
Yeah, so you have a few different groups. So primarily it's Indian domestic tourists. There, a lot of people from India haven't even seen the snow before, so they're just there to experience the snow. And, you know, a good day for them is just being in the snow, having a snowball fight, making snowmen, maybe taking a toboggan ride around the town. You get more adventurous ones that are learning to ski on the beginner slopes. There is a big golf course where they have a couple of surface toes that, that beginner skiers like to hang out. And then on the bigger mountains, well, you have a few Indian skiers. That market is starting to grow. There are definitely quite a few good experienced Kashmiri skiers. A lot of them are guiding now as well. And then in terms of the Western skiers, again, small numbers. You know, when we go there in late February into March, then, you know, there might be 50 people on the mountain. Last year when we were there in March, we had the whole mountain to ourselves.
Wow.
Anyone there. So it was pretty cool. It is a very unique place.
And it's also unique in the fact that I'm looking at their website right now. It's not really a typical Western ski resort, like here's all the runs. It looks like it's more, it almost looks like it's backcountry skiing.
It is. It's a lift accessible backcountry skiing. There is a ski area in inverted commas, and that is literally the first two bowls underneath the main gondola and where they have a new chairlift as well. But 95% of it is lift accessible backcountry. So you definitely need to be prepared for that. But yeah, you know, don't expect to go there and have marked trails and anything like that. It's all black runs, basically. They do have a trail map that gives you an approximate location and name of a ridgeline or a bowl. But, it's definitely different in terms of the infrastructure that you would find in a Western resort. I think the closest comparison would be Silverton ski area out of Colorado, which is very, very rugged. They have one chairlift. Gulmarg is way bigger, has, you know, a proper base area with the hotels and accommodation, restaurants and all of that, and the chairlift. And to be honest, you don't really need much more than that. If you are a strong skier or snowboarder, it's absolute heaven. All of that untouched powder that you can take from a lift, it's pretty cool. We don't go to, let's just say we don't go to India to ski moguls.
Okay, all right. Well, Matt, it looks like a fascinating trip. All three of the packages that you offer, all three of the destinations look really great. And I know a lot of people think about international skiing and something to consider. Matt, I'm going to put links on my website back to the Adventure Project, okay, so people can find you.
Yeah, and can I say one more thing?
Sure.
So we are about to, we are undertaking a big expansion right now. So every year we're going to be adding a new destination in the northern and southern hemisphere. And all of these destinations will fit the mold of exotic, snowshore, and relatively affordable. So upcoming destinations that we're about to add, as I said, we've got that new one in Tohoku in the North Island of Japan. That's starting up this year. If that goes well, we'll add that in 2020. In late March, when I get back from India, I'm going to Georgia to go and ski the Caucasus Mountains. Again, if that goes well, we'll add that in 2020. And then in July, we're starting up a new trip to New Zealand to go and explore these small independent ski areas called club fields. And then I'm even going to go and explore some new places in Chile at the end of our regular Chile program as well. And then we have lots of new destinations coming up after that. We're looking at, I think Spain might be the next one. I'd love to go to Russia if the political situation in Iran calms down. They have amazing...
I've always wanted to ski in Iran. They had World Cup skiing there at one time.
Yeah, it's similar to Gulmarg, where they get a lot of snow. There's hardly anyone skiing in the off-piste areas. Very affordable. And then now in Iran, they have something like 30 different ski areas.
Yeah.
A whole host of places you can go to. So we're just trying to do something a little bit different here at the Adventure Project. I'm trying to take people to places where other operators aren't currently going. You know, if you've ever been inspired by watching ski and snowboard movies where they go to these exotic places, that's the kind of stuff that we're inspired by and want to share with people as well. So that's what we're about.
Now, if skiing in India doesn't do it for you, maybe you're more of a backcountry person, but you don't have a lot of backcountry experience like myself. You've always wanted to try it. There is a place in Utah called Whisper Ridge. It's a resort on a family-owned piece of land that takes people backcountry on cats and helicopters. We have Don Lockwood from Whisper Ridge with us now. And I really wanted to visit this last year. It was on my radar. I was in Utah, but the snow didn't work out for me.
Well, if you were going to miss a year, last year was the year to miss.
Yeah.
But I would encourage you not to miss this one.
Well, I'm going to try to make it out here this winter. It's been on my, like I said, it's at the top of my bucket list for some time.
Well, let me help you with that if you get a chance.
Okay, definitely will. Well, first of all, tell people what Whisper Ridge is, because you say you're a resort, but it's really kind of much more than that. It's not really a typical ski resort. It's very, very different.
It's very different, yeah. Basically, we've all stood at the top of a ski run wondering what it'd be like to have it all to ourselves.
Yes.
for a day, that first chair experience is so special, you know. And what we've created here is a 78,000-acre first chair experience. At every canyon, every turn, every north face bladed slope is untracked powder. And so we're trying to ski it all, but we sure haven't. We're opening up new runs all the time. And, we've got a couple of helicopters in play now trying to get to some of the more remote things. We've added a big yurt village. It's kind of a little yurt city, actually, at the top of a 8,800-foot peak. We call it a perch. And, it's a pretty special place. It's back in about 12 air miles and get you right back in the most remote parts of the tenure. And you can literally ski from your front door.
This is 60,000 acres of prime powder skiing. And this is land that your family's owned for a very long time. Is that correct?
The ranch has been in the family for a long time. It has a really unique history. It's very rare to have property at elevation anywhere in the state of Utah or anywhere in the West, as the Forest Reserve set most of that property aside to protect the watersheds and the timber back in the 1800s. Well, the railroad was granted every odd section within a mile and a half of the rail grade that they worked as they were building the Transcontinental Railroad, and then did a massive land swap with the what was then the Forest Reserve. And our families and a few others bought that property from the railroad, which gave us all this private land at at elevation. And we've just recently bought, as of September 28th, another big ranch that was on our south boundary that kind of encompasses most of the north and east side of Powder Mountain Ski Resort.
I cannot wait to visit. Okay, so Dan, the question I have to ask, first of all, is you have skiing, you have cat skiing, you have heli skiing and all sorts of other things. But what if I wanted to go cat skiing? Okay, that's what I want to do. What is a typical day like for someone who wants to cat ski? You get there at what time and what do you do? And then how does it all start?
You get there at about 7 a.m. That gives you time to rent your skis and meet your guides and go through beacon training and have a light breakfast, get set up with the lunch for the day. And you'll meet the whole guide staff and the other riders either on your cat or other cats that are going out of your same cat base. Then at about 8:30, we depart for the mountain. The rides into the terrain to start skiing are between about 10 and 35, 40 minutes, depending on which zones we're going to. So you're typically skiing by 9 to 9:15, 9:20, Sometimes we'll break for lunch at the Yurt Village or some on some mountain peak if it's a bluebird day, but quite often people want to eat on in the cat. They're super comfortable cats with captain's chairs all facing forward, so we'll just ride along, listen to some music, eat lunch on the go, and get another lap in and keep that vertical coming. That's kind of that's probably the norm. And then by about 4:30, 5 o'clock, we're heading back to cat base. So it's not unlike a resort day in that it's about a 9 to 4 day. But if we have a little alpenglow started, or we, you know, it just a magical evening, we'll stay out just a little bit later. That's what a day looks like. And you'll get about, you know, we guarantee 8,000 to 12,000 vertical feet in a day. But it's not uncommon if you've got a group of guys that really ride together and are fast on their skis or snowboards, that the lap times speed up if that's the case. And quite often we'll get 14,000, 16,000, almost like a helicopter day.
You answered one of my questions by saying you start your day with a ski rental. So that's a question that a lot of people may have, because they may not have powder skis, but you guys rent special skis, powder skis, for this experience.
You know, we have a huge fleet, I would say, of powder skis. We have both in our fleet, DPS and Black Diamond. Depending on how deep the powder is, you know, we can waste the ski to match the day.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. So you've got a whole quiver there. So you just get the perfect ski for whatever the conditions are. That's really cool. Well, the question I have to ask is for a lot of people, what level of skier is this best accommodated for? I saw on your website that you kind of have like a little questionnaire, like where are you in your skiing? Like, for instance, for myself, I've never done any backcountry. I really want to do it. I think this place would be a perfect place for me to start. And I ski blues and blacks mainly. I don't have got a chance to do a lot of powder skiing because, you know, it's just whatever the resort offers that day. Where would I fall in on the skill level, and what are the different levels of skiers that have, you know, that come out to enjoy Whisper Ridge?
You know, I would say that you fall into an intermediate, you know, beginner powder skier, intermediate skier level.
Okay.
And, you know, we would start the day off in, you know, skiing some lower angled pitches and getting you comfortable with powder and, you know, really challenging you as it went on. And we would fit you with a cat of like abilityed skiers if possible. You know, we only ski to the ability of the weakest 20 or 30% of the cats. We want everybody to have a great time, but don't want to put anybody in danger.
Very
so
cool.
We don't take them into things that, you know, might get them hurt. One of the things we added this year, Mark, that's really makes Whisper Ridge very accessible to basically everybody, is we added some groomed runs on our north end near Powder Mountain. We bought a groomer. We gladed a bunch of runs coming off of what we call the Monument Headwall. And it's a fairly steep pitch right off the beginning, but it has really gentle shoulders off either side. And then you can ski down to what is a, you know, very gentle groomer coming down and get about 1,000 foot of vertical run. And the more aggressive skiers, what's kind of cool about that zone, the more aggressive skiers can ride the ridges out a little bit and get powder shots back to the groomer, back onto a ridge, back to the groomer, and ski along with. That way we can put somewhat mixed groups. So if we have folks that are really trying to get their feet wet, no pun intended, into the powder fields up there, they can get a little bit of pow, but get back to a groomer and be on something they're comfortable with and dip in and out of the powder. We just come off a 26-inch storm cycle, and you know, it was great to just ride that groomer out, dive off into the powder, get back onto the groomer, out onto a ridge. And we had everybody in the group was feeling good about skiing things that fit their ability. And so that's kind of a neat add. And then we have everything up to very steep couloirs that only the most aggressive skiers, you know, would dare challenge themselves on. So I think we have something for everybody, which is why we kind of coined the term the backcountry resort. Yeah, there's resort skiing, but it's heli-accessed groomer and cat-accessed groomer. Kind of weird, you know. super fun, and then it just goes up from there.
And how did all this get started? You know, you guys had this. You said you had this land in your family for a very long time. To be all of a sudden becoming this very unique type of ski resort.
So that's kind of a cool story, or one that's super meaningful to me anyway. My son and I, we used to do kind of a hybrid version of cat skiing on snowmobiles, where he would get on one side of the snowmobile and control the throttle on that side, and we had another throttle mounted on the left side. We'd ride each other up and on the snowmobile and drop off and take laps and just do hot laps off of a snowmobile. And it was a huge powder day maybe 10 years ago, 12 years ago. And we slid up underneath a tree and we're talking about life like any father and son do. And he's, you know, I said, what do you want to do? What do you want to study when you get up to school, up to college? And he says, you know, Dad, I'd really like to go into business. You know, I love the lifestyle that it's afforded you, and I love the challenges that come along with business. But my biggest fear is it's going to take me out of the mountains. And I had been scheming and hatching a plan for this operation for several years before that. And I turned to him and I said, well, I've got a thought related to that. It might work for both of us if you're interested. And I pitched the idea of he and I starting this company together.
Very cool. And before I let you go, tell people how the name Whisper Ridge came about, because I saw this in your it's a really cool story.
Yeah, we would take pictures of some of these trips we'd take into the backcountry and either share them with friends or later on post them on social media. People would say, where is that? And we didn't really want to cache a location, so we always said it, well, it's Whisper Ridge. And it's really this northern reach of the Wasatch that really doesn't have a name. On the map, sometimes it's called the Bear River Range, and sometimes it doesn't have a name at all, but it's this long, continuous ridge line. That we call Whisper Ridge, and it's always been kind of our family's well-kept secret.
And now you share it with everybody, and we're very grateful.
Oh, we're very humbled to do it, to be honest with you.
That's Don Lockwood from Whisper Ridge. Well, if you've been listening to this podcast for all 50 minutes, you say, you know, I loved it, but I need just a little bit more. Well, we have a little bit more skiing for you. First of all, if you want to go back to one of our previous episodes, episode number 44, and we'll have this on the blog, by the way, at travelwithhawkeye.net. We'll have it at the bottom. We talked to Tim Neville, who went skiing in North Korea and South Korea. One of my favorite podcasts. It got picked up by Ski Magazine. They sent it out also. Check it out there and find out about Tim's adventures skiing in North Korea and South Korea, which, by the way, North Korea and South Korea skiing, vastly different in each location. And also, episode 82... we did a little skiing in Taos, New Mexico, and we've talked to them about some of the changes they got going on out there, including a brand new airline that they've opened up to take skiers from Dallas and from Austin, right from those cities, right to the town of Taos. It's the only ski resort, only attraction that I know that owns their own airline, and that's on episode 82. And if you want just a little bit more skiing, make sure you join us on our Instagram at Hawkeye On Air. We got a couple of trips planned. We're supposed to be going to Park City in a couple weeks, and also in March, we're going to be going to Austria, going to Innsbruck, the site of the 1976 Winter Olympics. Our staff, which means my wife and my buddy Ed and Gary, will be going out there, and we want to share that with you on our Instagram story. So make sure you join us there at Hawkeye On Air on Instagram. I want to thank you so much. I hope you had as much fun listening to the podcast as I had putting it together, and I hope you found at least one thing that you want to put on your bucket list on this week's episode of Travel with Hawkeye. I'm Mark Hawkeye Lewis. This has been the Travel with Hawkeye podcast. Remember, the world is out there. Your adventure awaits.